They further advised him to dismiss the allied kings he had brought with him, sending them back to their own lands, and to keep their troops under his own command, appointing satraps in their place, and to levy from their own territory horses and chariots and men to fill the ranks of those who had been lost. Judging this advice sound, he reorganized his forces accordingly. At the beginning of spring, he took up his army and led it against the Hebrews, and on reaching a city called Aphek, he encamped in a great plain. Ahab, going out to meet him with his forces, pitched camp opposite him, though his own army was very small compared with the enemy drawn up against it. When the prophet came to him again and said that God was giving him the victory, so that he might show his own power not only in the mountains, but in the plains as well, a thing the Syrians did not believe possible, the two armies lay encamped facing each other in quiet for 7 days. On the last of these, at daybreak, when the enemy had come out of their camp and drawn up for battle, Ahab too led out his own forces to meet them. Joining battle, after a hard fight, he turned the enemy to flight and pressed the pursuit. Many of them perished under the chariots and at one another's hands, only a few managed to escape into their city of Aphek, and even these died when the walls fell upon them, 27,000 of them. In that battle, a further 100,000 were destroyed. Ben-Hadad, king of the Syrians, fled with a few of his most trusted servants and hid himself in an underground chamber. These men, telling him that the kings of Israel were known to be humane and merciful, and that by resorting to the customary manner of supplication, they might be able to win his safety from Ahab if he would allow them to go to him, he let them go, putting on sackcloth and wrapping cords around their heads, for that was the ancient Syrian manner of supplication. They came to Ahab and said that Ben-Hadad begged him to spare his life, and that he would forever be his grateful servant. Ahab said he rejoiced that Ben-Hadad was alive and had suffered no harm in the battle, and promised him the honor and goodwill one would show a brother. Having received oaths from Ahab that he would suffer no harm if he showed himself, they brought him out from the house where he had been hidden and led him to Ahab, who was seated on his chariot, and Ben-Hadad bowed before him. Ahab gave him his right hand, raised him up onto the chariot, and kissed him, telling him to take courage and expect nothing untoward. Ben-Hadad thanked him, acknowledged that he would remember this kindness his whole life long, and promised to give back the cities of the Israelites, which the kings before him had taken away, and to allow Ahab to establish markets in Damascus, just as his own fathers had had the right to do in Samaria. When oaths and a treaty had been made between them, Ahab gave him many gifts and sent him back to his own kingdom. Such was the end of the campaign of Ben-Hadad, king of the Syrians, against Ahab and the Israelites. A certain prophet named Micaiah came to one of the Israelites and told him to strike him on the head. For this, he said, he would be doing in accordance with the will of God. When the man refused, Micaiah foretold that because he had disobeyed God's command, he would be killed by a lion he would meet. This came about for the man, and the prophet then went to another and gave him the same order. That man struck him and shattered his skull. And Micaiah, having bound up his head, went to the king and told him that he had gone out with him to the campaign, and had been given custody of one of the captives by an officer, but that the captive had escaped, and he himself was in danger of being put to death by the man who had handed the prisoner over to him, since that man had threatened to kill him if the captive got away. When Ahab said that his death would be just, Micaiah undid the bandage on his head and was recognized by him as the prophet Micaiah. He had used this trick against Ahab in preparation for what he was about to say to him. For he told him that just as God had allowed him to let Ben-Hadad escape punishment, the man who had blasphemed against him, God would likewise pursue him and would cause him to die at that man's hands and his people to be destroyed by his army. Ahab, provoked at the prophet, ordered him shut up and kept under guard, and himself, troubled by Micaiah's words, went back to his own house. So Ahab was occupied with these matters. But I return now to Jehoshaphat, king of Jerusalem, who, having increased his kingdom and stationed forces in the cities within the territory of his subjects, established garrisons no less than his grandfather Abijah had done, when the allotment of Ephraim had been seized while Jeroboam ruled the 10 tribes. But he had the divine favor as his ally and helper, being righteous and pious, and seeking each day to do what was pleasing and acceptable to God. the peoples round about honored him with royal gifts, so that he amassed very deep wealth and won very great renown. In the third year of his reign, he called together the leaders of the country and the priests, and ordered them to go about the land and teach the whole people, city by city, the laws of Moses, and to keep them, and to be zealous in the worship of God. And the whole people took such delight in this that they prized and loved nothing so much as keeping the laws. The neighboring peoples continued to be devoted to Jehoshaphat and kept peace with him. The Philistines paid him fixed tribute, and the Arabs supplied him each year with 360 lambs and as many goats. He fortified great cities, among others strongholds, and had prepared a military force for wars. From the tribe of Judah, there was an army of 300,000 heavy infantry, commanded by Adnah, and Jehohanan commanded 200,000 more. This same commander also had from the tribe of Benjamin 200,000 foot archers, and another commander named Jehozabad contributed 180,000 heavy infantry to the king, apart from those he had sent to garrison the strongest cities. He arranged a marriage for his son Jehoram with the daughter of Ahab, king of the 10 tribes, named Athaliah. When some time later, Jehoram went to Samaria, Ahab received him warmly and entertained the accompanying army splendidly with abundant grain, wine, and sacrificial animals, and urged him to join in an alliance against the king of the Syrians, so that he might take from him the city of Ramoth in Gilead. For that city, which had first belonged to Jehoshaphat's father, had been taken from Ahab's father. When Jehoshaphat promised his help, for he too had a force no smaller than Ahab's, and had his army sent for from Jerusalem to Samaria, the two kings went out before the city, and, each seated on his own throne, reviewed their forces. Jehoshaphat asked that, if there were any prophets, they should be called and questioned about the campaign against the Syrian, whether they advised him to undertake it at that time. For peace and friendship had then held between Ahab and the Syrian for 3 years, ever since he had taken him captive and released him, up to that very day. So Ahab called together his own prophets, about 400 in number, and ordered them to inquire of God whether he would give him victory in a campaign against Ramoth and the overthrow of the city, on whose account he intended to wage the war. When the prophets advised him to march out, saying that he would defeat the Syrian and take him captive again as before, Jehoshaphat, understanding from their words that they were false prophets, asked Ahab whether there was yet another prophet of God, so that we may learn more precisely about the future. Ahab said there was, but that he hated him because he had prophesied evil things and had foretold that he would die defeated by the Syrian, and that he was now keeping him in prison. He was called Micaiah, he said, and was the son of Imlah. When Jehoshaphat asked that he be brought forward, Ahab sent a eunuch to fetch Micaiah. On the way, the eunuch told him that all the other prophets had foretold victory for the king. Micaiah said it was not permitted him to lie against God, but that he would say whatever God himself told him concerning the king. When he came before Ahab, and Ahab put him under oath to tell him the truth, he said that God had shown him the Israelites in flight, pursued by the Syrians and scattered by them into the mountains, like flocks abandoned by their shepherds. And he said this signified that the men would return home in peace, but that the king alone would fall in the battle. When Micaiah had said this, Ahab said to Jehoshaphat that he had told him a little while before what the man's disposition toward him was, and that he had always prophesied the worse for him. When Micaiah said that it was fitting for him to listen to everything foretold by God, and that the false prophets were urging him on to make war in the hope of victory, and that it was necessary that he fall in battle, Ahab fell to thinking it over. But a certain Zedekiah, one of the false prophets, came up to Micaiah and urged him not to attend to him, saying that he spoke nothing true. And he used as proof the prophecy Elijah had made, a man better able than Micaiah to discern the future. For he said that Elijah too had prophesied, in the city of Jezreel, in the field of Naboth, that dogs would lick up his blood, just as they had licked up the blood of Naboth, who had been stoned by the mob on his account. It is clear then, he said, that this man is lying, saying the opposite of what the greater prophet said, when he declares he will die within 3 days. And you will know whether he is telling the truth and has the power of the divine spirit in him. Let him at once, when struck by me, do harm to my hand, just as Adows withered the right hand of King Jeroboam when he wished to seize him, for I think you have certainly heard that this happened. So when he struck Micaiah and nothing at all befell him as a result, Ahab took courage and was eager to lead his army against the Syrian. For, I suppose, fate was prevailing and was making the false prophets more persuasive than the truth, so that he might seize the occasion of his own end. Zedekiah, having made horns of iron, said to Ahab that God signified through these that he would overturn the whole of Syria. Micaiah, not many days when Zedekiah, having said this, tried to escape punishment for his lying by slipping from one storeroom to another in hiding. The king ordered him seized and kept under guard at the house of Achaman, the ruler of the city, and given nothing beyond bread and water. Ahab and Jehoshaphat, king of Jerusalem, then took their forces and marched to Ramoth, a city of Gilead. The king of the Syrians, hearing of their advance, led his own army out to meet them and encamped not far from Ramoth. Ahab and Jehoshaphat agreed between themselves that Ahab would set aside his royal dress, while the king of Jerusalem would wear his own robes and take his place in the battle line, a stratagem meant to outwit what Micaiah had foretold. But fate found him even without the royal dress. For Adad, king of the Syrians, had instructed his commanders to give the army orders that no one else was to be killed, only the king of Israel. When the fighting began, the Syrians saw Jehoshaphat standing at the front of the line and, taking him for Ahab, rushed at him and surrounded him. But as they closed and they realized, he was not the man. They withdrew, and from early dawn until evening the two armies fought, with the Syrians winning yet killing no one, since by the king's order they were seeking only to kill Ahab and were unable to find him. Then, a certain royal page of Adad's, named Amminus, shot an arrow at the enemy and struck the king, piercing him through the breastplate into the lung. Ahab, however, would not let the wound become known to the army, for fear the men would turn and flee. Instead, he ordered his charioteer to wheel the chariot about and carry him out of the battle, since he had been struck hard and mortally. In pain, he stood propped in the chariot until sunset, and then, having lost much blood, he died. As soon as night fell, the Syrian army withdrew to its camp, and when the herald announced that Ahab was dead, they broke camp and went home. The body of Ahab was carried to Samaria and buried there. When the chariot, stained with the king's blood, was washed out at the spring of Jezreel, the truth of Elijah's prophecy was confirmed. Dogs lapped up the blood, and the very same courtesans who bathed there afterward went on washing themselves in that water. He died at Ramoth, exactly as Micaiah had foretold. Since then, everything the two prophets had said to Ahab came to pass. One should conclude that the divine is to be reckoned great, and worshipped and honored everywhere. That one must not judge the more pleasing and agreeable account to be truer than the one that is, and that nothing is more advantageous than prophecy and the foreknowledge it grants, since God supplies to men, through such means, the knowledge of what to guard against. One should also reflect, drawing on what happened to this king, on the power of fate, that even when foreknown it cannot be escaped, but steals upon human souls, flattering them with pleasant hopes, by which it leads them around to wherever it means to overpower them. Ahab too, it is clear, was deceived in his judgment by fate, so that he disbelieved those who foretold his defeat and put his trust instead in those who prophesied to please him, and so he died. His son Ahaziah succeeded him.